Further ado, I'd like to invite Laura Pidcock, MP for North West Durham. She's formerly a trade unionist and anti-racism activist. In fact, I remember her speaking at my union branch some 6 years ago to give racism the red card. So please give a very warm welcome to Laura Pidcock, who's also Shadow Minister for Labour as well.
Stop the War Coalition for an invitation to speak at this meeting. It is much more intimidating speaking at this meeting than in Parliament, and that's because I have much respect and admiration for every single person on this panel. And I think that Stop the War Coalition have been absolutely fundamental, I think, and instrumental in the way our politics is framed and the narrative on anti-war and how we have responded to the consensus that war is sometimes good. They have been consistently there to respond to that. So I want to say thank you to Stop the War Coalition across the nation for all of the work that they do. And I really do welcome the chance to talk about wider policy issues and the new global reality that we face, both in the scary world where we have Donald Trump in the United States of America, and then the hopeful world where we, you know, there's a bit more light, where we have Jeremy Corbyn, a lifelong peace activist, potentially, hopefully, when we get him into number 10. And I think I've mentioned one or two times before that Westminster can be a bit of a bubble, and that it's rare, or in the 8 months that I've been there, I have observed that it's very rare that we discuss these issues in the downtime, if you like, when Parliament's not responding to an immediate perceived crisis. And I think, in fact, it's one of the problems at the heart of the professionalisation of politics, that foreign policy is seen as kind of a separate discipline, that it's actually become a bit apolitical, the domain of experts in the party and amongst civil servants. So I'm not an expert, but I did become politically aware at a time when, as a country, we were being dragged into a war with Iraq, and I know the effect that that had on our politics and our movements since. I also studied disaster management and sustainable development in Northumbria University, actually, and considered long and hard how you build back communities after the catastrophe of war. And I think I have, I suppose, somewhat of a kind of childlike or pure, if you like, stance on war, is that I do not believe you can bomb your way to peace. It just seems completely illogical and irrational. I think we're all aware in this room, aren't we, of the challenges we face domestically in this country. Those of you that were in this building just a couple of weeks ago would have heard me speak about austerity, and in fact all of the panel, about austerity, universal credit, our low-wage economy, the cuts, the attack on our NHS, and the government being hell-bent on punishing people who are poor and disabled. We have a massive job to do domestically, but I think there's a real tendency in that environment to become very inward-looking, to ignore global situations, and you know, I suppose I have to be honest that with myself, you know, getting to grips with the issues in my own community, sometimes that is at the cost of talking about international issues. And I think that as internationalists, it's imperative that we have to look outside of our borders. There's a feeling from some that it's our job as an MP only to talk about our community. And in fact, sometimes on Twitter or Facebook, if I ever talk about anything that's not North West Durham, there'll be criticism. Why aren't you talking about North West Durham? What's this got to do with North West Durham? And I think that's very problematic. So sometimes it's difficult to create the space to talk about wider systemic global issues and the conflicts that arise as part of them. But as a movement, we absolutely have to do that. We don't, you know, it's not just remembering our internationalism and support for people all over the world suffering authoritarian regimes, but also to think what is happening, for example, in Yemen to our politics and society, because capitalism does not stop at borders. It has no respect for borders. The poverty, conflicts and instability that is created in different regions in the world are as a direct result of the global capitalist system. our historic role as an imperialist power, and I spoke a lot about this in my last job at Show Racism, the Red Card, and the decisions our government makes, whether that's to sell weapons to the Saudis, and there's a confident pronouncement on the government benches that that is absolutely fine to do, and again, this kind of positioning of that as logical and reasonable, and those bombs are dropping on Yemen currently, or the covert warfare that's happening all across the world in our name. And I think there's a dangerous idea that British involvement overseas has gone quiet, but we know that the very opposite is true. British military forces are active in 7 countries currently, and the arms sales that have not abated have a real and devastating effect. For example, 3.8 billion worth of UK arms have been sold to the Saudi regime since the beginning of the war. And there was, as you'd expect, a huge increase at the start of the bombing campaign against Yemen in March 2015. Let's not forget that Britain, and this is important in my role as the Shadow Minister for Labour, but that Britain is the second biggest arms manufacturer in the world, and arms industry is responsible for around 10% of British manufacturing. It's not just about arms sales either. It's clear that evidence of British involvement in logistical support for the bombing in raids in Yemen. And the world, of course, has become that little bit smaller and more dangerous with the election of Donald Trump in the White House. The thought of that, you know, man-child in charge of a red button, I'm sure there's not, you know, this red button, but that capacity to unleash hell on the world should us through us all. His provocation of North Korea via the medium of Twitter may seem funny on one level, but should never make light of the fact that the US has a nuclear arsenal capable of blowing the world apart. And the battles that were fought during the general election to defend Jeremy in his pronouncement that he wouldn't use that capacity, you know, the outrage that we saw on Question Time that he wouldn't blow apart or was not prepared to put humanity at stake seems such a very strange position that we were in terms of morality. And I think someone who sees his nuclear capacity as an extension of his manhood, potentially, and boosts the fragility of his ego is extremely worrying. But what worries me is the 63 million people that voted to give him that power. What has gone on to force those people out to place their name next to Donald Trump? For so many reasons, Trump is an absolute menace. His overtly racist statements, the sharing of Britain First propaganda, the Mexican wall, the Muslim ban, and his sheer misogyny are just a few reasons why we should not and never be affording him a state visit. And I'll be out on the streets supporting the demonstrations against Donald Trump if and when that happens. And the fact that Trump has asked for assurances that protests will be banned should be enough motivation for us all to make sure they are as loud and as strong and as vibrant as possible. And again, I'd like to thank, and you know, many of these people are in this room, I'd like to thank every single person that anytime there is a whisper of Donald Trump coming to this country, that they organise and make sure there's a protest against that. I am a firm believer that that makes a difference. So when Donald Trump asks Theresa May to ban those protests, we know that that's coming from a place of weakness and not from a place of strength, and that is the power of our movement. It won't happen. We will be out there to oppose him, come what may. And of course, we have had our own problems in the Labour Party. I think it would be a bit of an elephant in the room if I didn't say that. The decision to go to war with Iraq still casts shadows over the party. Of course, very few people other than Tony Blair himself, which keeps emerging every now and again, now defend that decision, but it had a massive effect, firstly and most importantly, in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqi civilians. And I still find it deeply upsetting when I think of countless human tragedies brought by that war. And as Tony Benn, I just watched this speech the other day actually, as Tony Benn so eloquently put it in the House of Commons on the eve of that invasion, when he said, "Aren't Arabs terrified? You know, aren't Iraqis terrified? Don't Arab and Iraqi women weep when their children die? Doesn't bombing strengthen their determination? What fools we are to live in a generation for which war is a computer game for our children and just an interesting little Channel 4 news item, and how true those words are. And I will never, ever forget, as an anti-racism worker in this city, when working with a group of young people who were quite far on their journey towards radicalisation, actually, who, you know, quite admire, one person that I worked with quite wanted to be the next leader of Britain First, and there was zero empathy when it came to conflict in other nations. And I will never forget playing a video of some people who were screaming over the death of their child from a bomb, and those children laughed and said, actually, you know, why are they trying to get the child out of that hospital? You wouldn't get away with that in England. Weren't tapping into the injustice that a bomb had fell where their child was and killed them. And it's something to be said, isn't it, about the consciousness of everyone in this nation. If you grow up just expecting that Britain has a right almost to invade other nations, what does that do to your consciousness? What does that do to how you feel, who you feel we are in the world, and the entitlement with which we have to enter other nations to sort out, as we position it, or the government positions it, sort out their problems? And I think the language of war has been sanitised deliberately to desensitise to the reality of the absolute brutality of war. So, you know, talk of surgical strikes, of collateral damage, of drone warfare must be challenged and the reality revealed. The cost of war is very rarely talked about, apart from in some kind of depoliticised sense. When we're asked to make a charitable donation on, you know, from a TV appeal. But these conflicts are always a result of political decisions, the global arms market and poverty. Failing to stop the war in Iraq, and I think this is another consequence, despite millions of people on the streets and many more millions at home who opposed the invasion, called in a question of whole democracy, didn't it? People often cite the expenses scandal that, you know, gave way to a massive distrust in politicians and people's public disengagement with politics. But I also think that quite a lot of that has to be laid at the door of Tony Blair and the Iraq war. It had a massive effect on internal dynamics on the Labour Party, the undemocratic nature of decision making, the impossibility to affect change through structures of the party was brought into focus by that conflict. At the time, it all seemed desperate, hopeless, but in retrospect, I think it was a tipping point. We can now see that many members who left the party, who became completely disillusioned with the Labour Party over the Iraq war, have returned, and they are determined to see that the Labour Party becomes a more democratic place where disastrous foreign policy decisions like the Iraq war can never be repeated. In fact, we also saw a kind of smaller demonstration of that when there was a massive mobilisation against the bombing of Syria in December 2015. We're just starting out on that journey, I think, but I think at least now we can be asking as a movement, and particularly as a Labour Party, I know not everyone in here is in the Labour Party, but what does an ethical foreign policy look like? We need to talk about this as a matter of urgency. Jeremy Corbyn talked a lot about foreign policy during the leadership elections. It's something that he's extremely comfortable with and knowledgeable about, and it was incredibly popular. When Jeremy talked about the need to apologise for the war in Iraq, his support spiked, not diminished. I think people understand, I think, that we're in a different place as a party now, but we need to take that message out onto the streets and in our communities and not be scared to talk about an ethical foreign policy, one that would seek diplomatic solutions instead of bombing. Doesn't seem too hard, does it? In our brilliant manifesto, the Labour Party said that we would place peace, universal rights and international law at the heart of foreign policy, suspend arms sales to Saudi Arabia, commit to working through the UN and ending support for unilateral aggressive wars of intervention, backing effective action to alleviate the refugee crisis, something which I think is very rarely talked about, but again, absolutely crucial. People do not leave their country of origin unless they are forced out, and very often that is a direct result of foreign policy decisions. Immediately recognising Palestine and standing up to Trump. And in Jeremy Corbyn's speech in Chatham House last year, he said, "Waiting to see which way the wind blows in Washington is not strong leadership. And pandering to a right Trump administration will not deliver stability. He's already been much stronger on Trump than our own Prime Minister." There are also important commitments to international development in the manifesto, sustainable development, the Modern Slavery Act, and a push for universal health coverage. The Labour Party has now taken a strong stance, hallelujah, against the bomb first, talk later approach to security. The job is definitely not done yet, but I think it offers us new hope. And combined with the movement for peace on the streets, represented by Stop the War and others, it offers the beginnings of what an ethical and more humane foreign policy might look like. And I think that is more important than ever. So I really look forward to listening to the rest of the speakers. And thank you so much for inviting me here today.
Thank you very much, Laura. And